Aloha, I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, November 13th. The government shutdown is officially over. Now what? We get reactions from Hawaii's lawmakers. What happens to the emergency programs put in place? We get details from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs about plans for its $6 million emergency fund. And today we're bringing you more war stories as we meet one Vietnamese family that struggled to adjust from leaving their home behind to finding their identity in a new country. We hear about the pride that keeps them strong. Plus, we meet a musician who draws on classical and slack key style for his unique take on Pacific soul. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. The federal government is resuming operations as the longest government shutdown in U.S. history came to an end yesterday. President Donald Trump signed a funding bill after it narrowly passed the House. Here with what it means for the people of Hawaii is HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
So lots happened yesterday. Why don't you bring us up to speed?
Yeah, a lot happened. You know, one of, I think, the main provisions of the funding bill was that federal workers are going to receive that back pay. So even including those who were furloughed, which there is a law that says that that's supposed to happen, but there were questions raised when President Donald Trump said that that might not be the case. But the funding bill includes that. So people will be getting back pay even if you were furloughed. And those who were fired during the government shutdown will also need to be reinstated. So Hawaii has 24,000 civilian federal employees that will be receiving that back pay. And depending on the department, payments are expected to start on Saturday and continue through November 19th. Some departments will get their regular pay this cycle, and then back pay will be added to the next paycheck. But I saw that air traffic controllers will be getting about 70% of their back pay within the next day or two, and then the rest at the end of the week. But I spoke with Hawaii's congressional delegation, Hawaii's congressional delegation, Senators Mazie Hirono, Brian Schatz, and Representatives Jill Takuda and Ed Case. They joined their fellow Democrats in voting against the spending bill, largely because it did not include expansions to the Enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. I spoke with Representative Takuda last night after the vote.
Today's vote ended the shutdown, but in no way is this a victory. We are reopening government. We're getting our federal workers the back pay they absolutely deserve. They should never have been in this situation, but we're slamming the door shut when it comes to access to affordable health coverage and health care for millions of Americans. This is a false choice Republicans put forward, that somehow we had to choose between reopening government and providing health care for our people. We could have and should have done both. And so I really see this as a missed opportunity to recognize that people in Hawaii and across the country are struggling.
So she mentioned healthcare subsidies there. That's where this all began, correct?
Right. Right. And so, you know, to rewind a little bit, because like, what are these enhanced subsidies, which the fight was over? Affordable Care Act enhanced subsidy started during COVID times and was renewed under President Joe Biden in 2022. And these enhanced subsidies are for those who use the Affordable Care Act, and they expire this year. Kind of the most general way to understand it is that the enhanced subsidies capped the cost of Affordable Care Act health insurance at no more than 8.5% of a person's income. And because of that, those who are currently shopping for next year's policy will likely be seeing large spikes in the cost of their health insurance. So, for example, in Hawaii, a family of four making $100,000 a year will pay over $350 more a month for health insurance if they're getting their insurance through the Affordable Care Act. You know, there are about 23,000 people in Hawaii who do get their insurance through the Affordable Care Act, and many of those people are small business owners, gig workers, or those who work off of commissions where their employer is not not required to provide health insurance. And Hawaii has the second lowest rate of uninsured people in the country. But Hawaii Insurance Commissioner Scott Saiki says that, you know, those increased costs could push residents to actually forgo health insurance. And he's anticipating that younger people who are like generally more healthy and feel like they don't need really robust health care will drop their plans, and it'll cause ripple effects throughout the whole healthcare system.
We'll probably see an increase in the rate of uninsured people in Hawaii. And we all know what happens when you have more uninsured people. They end up in the emergency rooms. And then those costs are passed on, not just to hospitals and providers, but they're passed on to all residents in the state. So in the end, we're all paying a portion of this uninsured cost.
So did you hear anything about what lawmakers are hearing from constituents about this?
Yeah. Representative Takuda says that she's already heard from constituents who are seeing these higher prices because enrollment started this month and will continue into December. She says House Democrats really want to force a vote on their bill that would extend those enhanced subsidies for another 3 years before January 30th, which is when the funding bill will next run out. And I asked her if that means that, you know, come January 30th, if we could see another situation like this where the government is shut down.
We can't have that. That can't be an option. This last shutdown should never have happened, but Republicans, the Trump administration, forced that position by not even showing up to vote, by canceling votes literally for the last 7 weeks. That was a choice Republicans made to force the longest shutdown in government history to happen. We cannot allow them to do it again. We must not allow them to do it again. We need to work in earnest throughout this month, the next, through into January, to make sure that our federal workers and the people of this country don't have to endure the hardship and pain they've just went through again.
So here in Hawaii, we have a good sense of what's happening on the Democratic side of the aisle. But what's happening on the other side of the aisle?
Yeah, you know, I've seen reports that Republicans are putting together their own healthcare solution that includes depositing cash into accounts that people can spend on healthcare instead of giving the funds directly to insurance providers. But experts are saying that it would really cause the collapse of the Affordable Care Act because, you know, similarly to what Saiki said earlier, is that it would cause healthier people to get cheaper insurance with less coverage, and only the sickest people would really use the Affordable Care Act, and it would throw off the risk pool entirely, and you could see insurers start exiting the market if that happens. Kind of going forward, I asked, you know, Representative Takuda what she hopes Hawaii residents kind of took away from this whole shutdown.
I hope they understand that the Trump administration, the Republican majority we have right now, they're cruel, you know. It's been a long night, and I will say that all I walk away with is a pain in my heart that they couldn't even focus on making sure everyday Americans had access to health care, that we could feed people, that this Trump administration literally took it all the way to the Supreme Court to withhold food money from hungry Americans when Congress put billions of dollars into a contingency fund to allow those cards to be filled.
So, and I know that the state has stepped in the last few days in terms of trying to fill the gap with SNAP. Talk about where that stands now.
Right. People should have received their full benefits from SNAP at this point. And then also the state used kind of millions of dollars of its own money to provide $250 for every person who's on SNAP in Hawaii. You know, Governor Green says they'll be asking the federal government for a reimbursement for those state funds that it used. But in previous briefings, the Hawaii Department of Human Services said that the federal government made it very, very clear that if they use state funds to provide SNAP, they should not expect to be reimbursed for those funds.
Seems like a long shot ask.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is for listeners that SNAP recipients should, moving forward, not see any interruptions.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Ashley. We really appreciate the update, and I'm sure there'll be more to come, especially as we move into January. We've been hearing from HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. You can check out her coverage of government shutdown and other issues on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. So now that the shutdown is over, what happens to the emergency programs that were put in place to help furloughed workers? What happens to those who worked without a paycheck or those who are on the federal food assistance program? The Office of Hawaiian Affairs began accepting applications on Monday for $6 million in aid that the board set aside to help Native Hawaiians who qualify. OHA Chairman Kai Kahele talked to Catherine Cruz earlier this morning about what happens next.
This government shutdown is officially over. What happens to the OHA
Emergency
fund?
Relief aid.
Yes.
So it continues because we know that even though the government is starting to reopen, that reopening is going to take some time. You know, the government has been shut down for 41 days and you just don't turn the lights back on and everything goes back to normal where it was on September 30th. So we know on OHA's Native Hawaiian beneficiaries are going to continue to hurt from the government shutdown, especially those that had to go to work for 41 days as accepted or essential employees and were not given the opportunity to stay home. They had to go to work and they never got paid for 2.5 paychecks. And so there's a lot of catching up to do there. And for those that had stopped receiving SNAP benefits, we know that they need help as well. So our program is continuing, and we plan to disperse all $6.1 million as soon as we can. We're doing that through the Hawaiian Council right now.
Right. And you just opened up for applications this
Monday.
Week.
We did. Hawaiian Council officially launched and started taking applications at 9 a.m. on Monday morning. The response has been overwhelming at its statewide locations. People were lined up at Hawaiian Council's offices on Monday. Right now, we have a total dispersed funds, a little over $100,000 that have gone out.
Really? That's
total
quick.
Applications received, just under 2,000. We've awarded, like I said, almost $100,000 to federal workers who received $1,200 checks in the mail that were of Native Hawaiian ancestry and were furloughed. And our SNAP applications are about 900, and we've awarded a little under $10,000, $350 gift cards for our beneficiaries at three different vendor locations, Foodland Times and KTA on the different islands. And then on those islands that are a little bit more rural, Molokai and Lanai, we are just sending them $350 cash payments.
I'm just impressed with the speed at which, you know, the aid is going out to people.
It is. You know, we sensed that this was happening about the middle of the month, and we were planning in the event that the government did not reopen what would happen at the end of October, especially as it related to SNAP. And so the Board of Trustees convened an emergency session. Our team has been working nonstop for the last 2 weeks, and we were able to put together a program really quickly and partner with the Hawaiian Council, who has expertise in this type of distribution. The Hawaiian Council led or was part of an effort to lead distribution of this type during COVID and also during the Lahaina wildfire. So this is not their first rodeo, and we knew that they could do it and do it very quickly.
Even when you look at state government, you know, how quickly they were able to get that $250 aid out to families.
Yeah, the Hawaii Relief Program from Governor Green, which is fantastic. You know, the governor's $250 cash payment on recipients' EBT cards coupled with OHA's $350 SNAP payment on a gift card, in addition to when the federal government said you can load people's SNAP cards last Friday for a few hours before the Supreme Court reversed that decision, the state of Hawaii pushed a button, loaded everyone's EBT cards. And so here's a great example, Catherine. One of our beneficiaries had 8 cents on their EBT card on October 31st. 8 cents. They received the governor's $250, and they received their $166, which is what their SNAP distribution was, when the state loaded everyone's EBT cards on that Friday. So that beneficiary, when they went to check their EBT card, had $416.08 on their EBT card. They were so grateful for the state and the governor. And they will now receive, in addition to that, because they are a qualifying and eligible beneficiary under OHA's Emergency Relief Program, a $350 gift card to a participating supermarket where they live. And so that is one example of an individual that is going to be able to make it through the month of November, you know, especially during the holidays, and have a little bit extra than they would have had. Can you imagine someone gets $166 a month on their EBT card for food? That's impossible to survive on that. We have estimated we're going to be able to give 15,000 Native Hawaiian beneficiaries a $350 gift card or a cash payment, and 1,000 Native Hawaiian beneficiaries who work for the federal government a $1,200 cash payment. And we're trying to move that money as fast as possible.
What do these applicants need to know? What kind of paperwork do they need to have in order to qualify?
It's a great question. First of all, you need to be qualified as a Native Hawaiian beneficiary under the Office of Hawaiian Affairs through our Hawaiian Registry Program. So you go to oha.org, you apply. You can literally do it on your phone. You can upload your documents, sign everything, submit. The OHA team will verify your eligibility. What we are seeing are people submitting applications without the proper documentation. And so that's really important. Your birth certificate says that you have Native Hawaiian ancestry or one of your parents do. You submit that. That's probably the best document to submit. You will get a Hawaiian registry card and a Hawaiian registry card number. And with that number, you apply through the Hawaiian Council's website for the emergency relief aid. And it's pretty black and white. If you're a verified OHA beneficiary, you are single with no dependents, kupuna age 60 or over, you're going to qualify for the program. And so we wanted to fill the gap where other government agencies were not able to fill, especially as it relates to the Native Hawaiian community.
So if they didn't qualify for one bucket of money, you at least are there as another safety net.
It was, because the target program for the state's program and other programs was to help those with dependents, right? Those with children, those who had minors in their family. We wanted to make sure that those people and those families received aid, so they were in a better place than they were. But those that did not have dependents were not going to receive any aid. And so we focused on that gap. And so that's what we've been seeing in terms of applicants. We're also seeing those that are disappointed because they aren't able to take advantage of OHA's program because they do have dependents. But they did receive aid from other sources, and there are other programs for them, those with families. We're focused on the ones that don't have dependents.
Okay. All right. But if you can get your paperwork in order, you'd get a faster response.
And the OHA Hawaiian Registry Program is important. It's you either have it or you don't, and if you don't, you don't qualify.
Okay. Switching subject matters on you, I know this week you came out and were concerned. You want the Office of Hawaiian Affairs to be at the table when we're talking about these military leases that are expiring.
Yes. You know, we are and have asked the governor for the opportunity to serve in a couple different capacities on the governor's team as it relates to the military land leases. The governor sent a letter on October 29th to the Secretary of the Army, and what he described was within 10 days the creation of a joint negotiation team and a technical working group that would be co-chaired by a designated state agency. And so the letter we sent to the governor was to make sure that we had a formal request, that the Native Hawaiian community, as represented by OHA, had a formal request in the process that the governor has articulated, and that OHA or a Native Hawaiian voice has a seat and a role on that joint negotiation team. And then our suggestion was that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs would co-chair this joint or this technical working group with the Board of Land and Natural Resources, with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And so, you know, through the governor's letter, he talked about designating a state agency. Likely the DLNR would be one of those state agencies in consideration because of its responsibility over the state's public lands where Pohakuloa is situated. And we would like OHA to be part of that process as well.
So, have you gotten a response from the governor yet?
It sounds like the governor is going to do something and it'll be announced soon, but we haven't got anything definitive yet.
And the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, the trustees are meeting this week.
We did. We had a board meeting yesterday, and we're meeting today. We have an action item on our agenda. We expect the public to come out to testify on this issue. And OHA is going to be starting to take a more proactive role in the military land lease issue as it relates to Native Hawaiians, OHA and the state's responsibility to the public land trust, and how important these lands are to not only Native Hawaiians, but to the broader general public and the state of Hawaii.
And we do have these new, they call them HIMAR, these long-range missiles that I think are being tested at Pohakuloa this week as part of the exercises. And you've seen this in action?
I have. I have seen it in action. And it's interesting you asked that because the Board of Trustees yesterday, so now the Office of Hawaiian Affairs has taken a position, at least in committee. It's going to be before the board in a few hours today, as part of OHA's 2026 legislative package, to have a bill presented to the legislature that would place a question on a 2026 ballot for a constitutional amendment. And that question would be, should live fire training be prohibited in the state of Hawaii on its public trust lands? That's a question that we think the people of Hawaii is ready to answer and should answer in 2025. That bill and that resolution passed overwhelmingly at the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs convention just 2 weeks ago. So we know a large section of our Native Hawaiian community supports that. We also think and have a feeling that the broader community, Native Hawaiian or non-Native Hawaiian, would support that as well. And that would be on the state's public trust lands that it controls.
And we did see the military pull back at Makua. They're talking about possibly reducing their footprint, giving up some of the Makua land, if they can get those leases at Pohakaloa. How are you looking at the
You know, in Congress, I was the first member of Congress that called for the total complete return of Makua Valley to the people of Hawaii. Not just the 700-ish acres of state land in the front of Makua Valley, but the entire valley itself, including the federal land. And appropriate money from Congress to clean up that land. It was called the Leandra Vai Act, named after one of the founders and the leaders of Malama Makua. And I still stand behind that. And I think most people in Hawaii do stand behind that. Just think of the word Makua. It means parent, right? It's something that is cherished and should be taken care of. And that is Makua Valley. And that should come back to the people of Hawaii in its entirety, not just a portion of it. And there's extensive military ordnance and cleanup that has to be done. We saw what happened on Kaho'olawe, where the United States spent over $500 million or almost $500 million on attempting to clean up Kaho'olawe. And Kaho'olawe is, I don't think it's even 50% cleaned up today. And so we know there's a lot of ordnance, whether it's exploded or unexploded ordnance, that exists throughout the Hawaiian Islands. And those are things that the military needs to address. We often get UXOs, grenades, and things that pop up in Waimea at one of the schools there a few years ago on the beach just out on the shoreline of Makua. These happen every day, and they happen often. And it's something that we need to address as a people and as a community.
That was OHA Chair and former Congressman Kai Kahele talking to Catherine Cruz about the renewal of military land leases and what happens to OHA's emergency relief program now that the government shutdown has ended. This week, we've been taking a look back at the stories of wartime. Monday, we highlighted a Marine colonel who was taken prisoner of war when the island of Guam was invaded by the Japanese during World War II. And yesterday, we learned about Operation Babylift, hearing from one of the orphans who was adopted by a family on Kauai 50 years ago. Today, we introduce you to a University of Hawaii educator who previously received a Community Leadership Award from the FBI. Her name is Tawn Truk Nguyen, but she likes to be called Truk. She spoke with the conversation's Catherine Cruz and takes us back to the fall of Saigon in April of 1975.
So when we left at the end of the war, the fall of Saigon, I was only 4 months old. And so as a baby and as a girl, there was a choice by my family to perhaps I didn't need to go. But it was important for my older brother to go because he was a boy. And as we know in Asian communities and families, boys are very revered and very beloved in the previous generations. And so there was a decision by my family that my mom and my father could only really care for one child in this very tumultuous time. So they took him, and I ended up on the helicopter that apparently flew from the embassy over to my grandparents' house. And I was hoisted onto the helicopter somehow. The stories vary, but somehow I was with my three uncles at the time, who were teenage boys. Somehow they worked with my grandfather to get me onto that helicopter. There are stories of how I was thrown at it, like American football is what they say now. There are stories about how I was wrapped in my grandmother's blanket that my mother recognized. And so she said, oh, that's my package. And there's stories of how she has a hard time talking about these things, but my mother will say she thought I was food because it was a small bundle. I was small. And then she realized it was me, and the copter was in the air the whole time. So there's those stories that I didn't learn about until I was in my late 20s. And so it doesn't feel like mine in a way. It's my mother's story. And she still has a very hard time talking about things because of so many things that she went through, the situations, the heartache, the violence of the time, the things that she had to do when we were in a refugee camp. So at the end of the war, my family was one that my father could read and write English. And so he worked for the embassy for a time period. And my mother was a good typist. And so she typed things, even though she didn't understand what she was typing. And so because of that, we were on a list to be airlifted out. So we weren't part of the boat people community. We were actually part of a group that was able to end up in refugee camp, and we could wait for an airlift out of the refugee camp, which was on Wake Island. From what my mom will share, what she's willing to share, we were there for about a year and a half, separated from my father at the time because they couldn't find each other. So she was on her own with two young children, and the community members, they rallied around her like other young moms, and they stood in line and got rations for her to feed her two kids because she couldn't stand in the line because I was so sick during that time period. She was just worried that how I would survive. So after about a year and a half, my mom doesn't talk about the camp time period. We ended up here in Hawaii. And because my hometown is Nha Trang, which is in South Vietnam, a little bit north of Saigon, now known as Ho Chi Minh City, a beach town is a beach town. Come from a fishing village is what Nha Trang was. Now it's very developed. It's got sidewalks and beach umbrellas, and it's a gorgeous town. But my mom looked around here and she said, "This reminds me of home." And so she asked my father, who reconnected with her towards the end of the camp time period, "Can we stay in Hawaii?" Because they had offered to move us on to the mainland where there were missionaries ready to receive refugees. So we could have gone to California, we could have gone to Atlanta, Georgia, and other areas across the U.S. But she asked, "Let's stay here because there's fishing here." And that's what connects me still back to my hometown, is this idea of the ocean. And so the Vi here, it really, I see it as a connecting point, not as a divisive point, but something that connects me back to my hometown. So we stayed, and my mom, being someone who could type, continued to help to type documentation for other refugees who were coming in. She learned enough English to help translate all of the official government documents, how to request government assistance for food, how to request housing, how to do your taxes, and most importantly, how to get your citizenship, how to study for it. And I went through that with my mom because I was born in Vietnam. I didn't have citizenship at the time. So I studied with her, helped her to translate, help all the families who came to our apartment in Makiki. I grew up there and we studied together. And when it came time to take the exam, we all passed and did the whole oath of office down there on Ala Moana Boulevard.
Do you remember that day?
I do remember that day. It was amazing because Vietnamese people have a very specific accent. To hear all of that coming from this huge Vietnamese community saying the oath of citizenship was, for me as a preteen, I was either 12 or 13 at the time, maybe 12. It was like a voice, and I thought, am I giving up my Vietnamese-ness? I don't think I am. I'm still Vietnamese. My first language is Vietnamese. But at the same time, I looked around and I remember my mom was a little teary-eyed because for her, she was questioning, am I giving up my homeland?
Your identity.
And at the time, the borders weren't open yet. She could not go home to Vietnam until, I think it was early 90s or the late 80s. So that's my story. And I wish I could tell more about the trials and tribulations my mother experienced, my father experienced, but they won't talk about it. And my aunts and uncles, they tell me, don't ask your mom because it's too traumatizing for her. It's hard for her to talk about. Every so often now, she'll share a story and I'll just stop and listen. Sometimes she tells the story one way and the next day it's a little different.
But otherwise you don't press her then, yeah?
I don't press. And many people have asked me over the years, why don't you write it? And my mom has asked me, she knows I'm a writer. She knows I love to write. And I'll write crazy things sometimes. And she asked me not to write it because she didn't want to answer questions from other people who reads my material. Given I'm a scholar at the university, she said, you write and people read it. I don't know who reads it, but people do. And I don't want phone calls and I don't want people to ask. So I want to honor that of my mom. So I have little notes here and there, journals that I write to myself. just the other night, we had a conversation because of this conversation here today. And I was asking her questions about particular things, and she brought out a dusty box of VHS tapes and DVDs, and she said, "Can you play this? Can you give this to Miss Cruz? Can she play it?" And I said, "I don't know if she has a DVD player, but I'm pretty sure she has access to one." And there were things that she was telling me about that are explained. She said, "All of this explains it." And I said, "Oh, is it in English or is it in Vietnamese?" And she goes, "I don't know. I've never watched it because I don't have a DVD player." But she got her hands on it after we got rid of the DVD. So I'm looking for a way to play that back for her. But I think I located it on YouTube. So I'm going to watch it with her sometime in the next couple of days just to see if it is that.
That was Truc Nguyen, whose family story we're highlighting on our show today. We will have more right after a short break.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Visionaries are essential when you're creating something new. But you also need people who can translate that vision into something tangible.
And I think those are the people who have contact with ground reality.
The Alchemy of Success, for businesses, creative endeavors, and more, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii Foundation. Its 4UH for Hawaii campaign connects donors with UH to fuel innovation and entrepreneurship across the islands. UHfoundation.org.
Let's get back to our conversation between Catherine Cruz and Truc Nguyen. The UH educator was singled out for a Community Leadership Award from the FBI for her work in internet safety in our schools.
What has that experience done to help make you who you are today, knowing your family's history and the secrets?
Yeah, I would say I am shaped by my mother, her humor, her resilience, her absolute commitment to giving me and my two brothers a good life here in the U.S. I have a younger brother who was born here in Hawaii. My older brother and I were born in Vietnam. And we carry with us this dual life, if you will. In Vietnam, we're seen as the elders in our generation, me and my older brother. But we don't know half of our family very well. They recognize us for who we are. And just because of your hierarchical birth, you automatically receive a certain level of respect. So we go to Vietnam and we experience this and we're like, wow, did we earn this? And earning respect is an American concept. It really is. Whereas in Vietnam, it's you have it. You're supposed to have it because of your birthright. And so we struggle with this, but we take on the responsibilities of being elders in our generation. It also carries with it a certain level of respect we give to the upper generation, our older generation too. But I think that sense of resilience of being able to do anything you put your mind to is something I gained from my mom. She will try anything. To this day, she hears of an idea and she will try the idea. It's not always successful. I will say it's sometimes humorous, trying to figure out how to make a backpack out of jeans from Ross's because it's on sale, down to trying to, when I earned my master's, she decided she was going to earn her GED. So she said, "You're studying, I want to study too." So we were back studying together again. The first time we studied together was for our citizenship. The second time we studied together, I was finishing my master's degree at UH Manoa, and she wanted her GED. Because she said if she had her GED, she could apply for management positions, and she was working at Consolidated Theaters in Waikiki 3 Theater, this beautiful theater. Pipe organ at the front was gorgeous. And the day that, or I will say the year that I graduated with my master's, she earned her GED, just a few, I think, weeks apart. So we had this huge celebration, and it wasn't really for me.
It was for mom.
It really was for mom, because she did it all. But that shaped me a lot, and I know it shaped my older brother and my younger brother. It's been a different life for him because he's born here, and he identifies very much as an American. And only now, he's not just now, but as an adult, he's recognized the Vietnamese-American aspect to it.
And then what does your family think because of these times, what you see happening with immigrants and their status, whether they have green cards or they have visas? What are you thinking?
You know, I'm in education, right? I'm an education professor, College of Education faculty member, and I believe so strongly that education is a way up, not necessarily out. I don't want people to think that education is a way out, but it is a way up and it is a way forward. And with these green card and visa issues, and with even other international students that I work with at UH Manoa, having that just taken from them has been heart-wrenching. For the Vietnamese community, it's been hard. We have heard stories of families being ripped apart, being sent away, of people questioning whether they're there legitimately or not, of the way that you survive in a new country. Those survival strategies that people had are now being questioned, and they're being deported. So I'm not saying that everyone absolutely followed the laws, but everyone is trying to survive, even to this day. So I'm just heartbroken by it all. I can go on record, I don't agree with the current policies. I think there needs to be a little more grace, a little more empathy, a lot more empathy by our government. But some people are trying to carry out their duties as they are assigned or not assigned, and it's a hard time right now.
What do you want to say to people who are watching this play out and may not have those fears that the immigrants in this country have today?
People who don't have the fears are people who are born into a place of, we talk about privilege a lot in our work. Knowing what privileges you have that you were born into gives you a good sense of place within the society that you're in, whether you chose to be there or whether you were forced to be there. We talk about children being where their parents chose to be. And as you grow into adulthood, you get to then choose where you want to be and what peoples you want to be around. And if you want to be a good friend, a good neighbor, a good wife, husband, family member, you need to listen to the struggles that people have had, and even listen to the struggles that they didn't have. Because if they didn't have the struggle, it's our responsibility then to listen and share some of what we went through. It's not to change people's minds, though. It's just to share, and hopefully they're willing to receive. But I would say for people who have not experienced it, if they would just listen and be open to listening, and not listening with a judgmental perspective, but one where they're curious and wondering what it is that we went through. It was hard growing up. It was hard. I tell these stories of elementary school where I would have to wear a bracelet with vocabulary cards on it. And it's all because I was in the language immersion program, because my name, I never changed it to an English name. The judge asked me during citizenship time, would you like to change your name? And I said, no, I like Truck. Truck is fine. And he's like, but is that really your name? I'm like, that really is my name. It's just pronounced differently here in the U.S. because people have a hard time saying Truck. So Tan Truck, that's my name. And so here they say Truck, and I respond to it. He said, I think you'd be better as Tracy. Your life would be easier. And I'm like, would it be? But I like Truck. It's strong. It's got a lot of verve to it. I can run over boys and say, my name is Truck. But he really tried to convince me to be a Tiffany or a Tracy or anything with a T, especially TR. And I said, no, I think I want to stick to that. But it was telling that a judge was advising me at a very impressionable age that life would be easier if you had an American name. And you know what? That was happening to so many of my friends. So many of them had, it's not that they abandoned their ethnic name, it's just that their families had decided it would be easier if they took on a U.S. American name. And then we all went to college, and now we have gone back to our ethnic given cultural names. And it's beautiful. I think it's a beautiful thing. But yeah, I would say listen. Listen with an open mind, a wondering one, a curious one, not a judgmental one.
That was Hawaii educator Truk Nguyen, who was reflecting on her life in Hawaii following the fall of Saigon 50 years ago. We hope you've enjoyed our look at war stories this week. If you missed any of the segments, you can find them on our website or on Spotify or Apple. South Pacific Pocket Soul meets Motown Revival. That's how Steven Henderson describes his music. The singer-songwriter hails from Hana, Maui, and brings a perspective to his music informed by family, love, and grief. Henderson is one of the artists featured in HPR's Live from the Atherton Celebrate 808 concert series. It kicks off this weekend and lasts through the month of November. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Henderson. He starts off by performing a new song, Where's the Water Flowing?
When my head sinks into new lows, when my blood starts running slow, when I can't keep the voices out, it's you who keeps my heart. Oh, it's you who knew me from the start. When there's thunder in my chest, yeah. When my dreams won't let me rest, when my fire fades into the ground, it's you who walks me home. Oh, it's you who never lets me down. 'Cause all my bones are in this river. Mother brought me as a child. Every stone would tell a story of every storm gone by. With every changing tide, where's the water flowing? Yeah. Where's the water flowing? Yeah, yeah.
Try that to start.
We have to talk about the falsetto. We have to talk about your voice. Nature or nurture?
That one came from probably a little bit more on the nurture side of the house. When I was a young child, of course, like before my voice dropped and I became a 6'4", 290-pound man, I had pretty high voice already, but my mother made me learn just the leokai with my aunties and uncles over in Hana. My auntie Cecilia Kupau and my uncle Vinton Castro really were my mentors during my time in Hana when I was a young kid. And we grew up with Namele growing up, just in the song contests, you know. And so I had to learn falsetto singing and like yodeling when I was a kid under the Hawaiian style, like, kind of stuff. And it just stuck. It never left me and I've always used it.
I'm glad you talked about your childhood because I read that your father was actually the producer of the group The Jets in the 90s. And so your first kind of musical touring experience was with them. How did that shape you as a musician?
In terms of shaping, it was probably one of the like deeper core memories I know as a kid of like what music means and what a family band means and like what it means to have like a group of people who you love, like all trying to make music together and also trying to like make it big and go out on tour and doing what they were doing at the time. And so it was really a model, I think, for me to really learn what it felt like to pursue music with people you love, and also the challenges that can come along with that as well, you know, while being within the family. And I think probably the last big formative thing for me, their musicianship was like just unbelievably high. And so they were always practicing. So it was a very, very inspiring time for me as a kid to just learn what that felt like. And also just get addicted to sibling harmony, because I have siblings and we've always grew up singing together as a crew. Yeah, I think that sort of just permeates through most of my music still today.
You count among your influences Gaby Pahanui and Ludwig van Beethoven. Make that make sense.
Yep, 100%. I got exposed to Kiwalu when I was such a young child. And just being in Hana, being raised, learning Uncle Vinton and learning the styles of Uncle George called Moku, and just learning and listening to Hawaiian music and Hawaiian falsetto. So it's like an anchor. I think Gabby's music especially, I think, is a spiritual and emotional anchor for me, just because it's so deeply ingrained into my listening habits as a child. And my mother was a hula dancer, and so we just grew up listening to him and listening to many of the Hawaiian, like early Hawaiian artists at the time. She made us listen to the classics. And my grandma too. My grandma was a huge Alfred Apaka fan. So she was like, oh, you got to listen to the golden voice. You know, you got to hear it. You know, think of that as foundations for me. And I learned piano as a child. And then I went to school. I went to study music at Stanford University when I was 18. And that was really when I got like thrown into the world of classical music and classical music history. And Beethoven, man, Beethoven's just one of those guys who, upon his arrival, everything changed. Like there wasn't, I don't think there was a single more like sort of polarizing figure in music history where he learned how to break every rule in the best ways. And his relationship with music historically it was beautiful. I think one of my favorite quotes with him was just like, hey, like, thank God for music, basically. According to its virtue, it's given me life, you know? So it's one of those things that I've always admired about Beethoven. And his music also sort of found its way into my being as I studied a lot of the Romantic classical composers, and then later on into some of the modern era with people like Debussy, et cetera. But that's just stuff, you know, it's like you get addicted to it. It hits you and you're like, oh my gosh, I really like that. And I want to just keep going with that. I want to listen to more of it. And how he was able to emote, I think, was really the thing that I just like, it hit me to the core. So I don't know how to make it sense other than the fact that it became such a core part of my story. And it's an influence and a hero of mine.
How do you think your style or the themes you're interested in exploring as a songwriter and performer have changed as you've gotten older and kind of now at this place getting to devote more time to a music career than where you were even a decade, 15 years ago?
Well, that's a really great question. So I do think that previously I was of the feeling or of the philosophy that I had to have one sort of very unique thing, sound, call it, that I created, and that was going to be me. That was my voice and my sound, and spent forever really just like finding my way through a bunch of different genres trying to understand what that really was. That has changed a lot since having kids and realizing like, hey, you know, every genre that I'm writing in or things that I'm putting out in, I'm totally okay now. Just like putting things, packaging them together and sending them out as a thing and then not worrying about what they are. In terms of like influence roadmap, you know, in terms of like how my music has changed and like evolved over the last like couple of decades, I really started in the surf rock and soul genre period. Like I think my very first album I ever listened to, full cover, was Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And it was just like the thing that changed my life. And I just wanted to be in that deep soul, neo soul / hip hop realm for such a long time. You know, raised on Motown and Hawaiian music, and then took a turn, went into Jack Johnson for a long time. And in college, I was like all about Bon Iver. I was like really into the folk side of the house. I was just like, I need to just explore this. I love this so much. It's doing something for me. And then took time just going around the horn through a lot of those folk soul, you know, blues ish influences. And I just think it took 2 decades to marinate and to like find their way into me and to be in a place where I feel like I can own what I've got. The common thread is always story. And for me, like, especially stories that are unique to my life and unique to the perspectives that I have as a Native Hawaiian, as a middle child, someone who's lost, you know, two parents to cancer, who has two kids, who the third on its way, who's felt what it was like to grow up in Hawaii, be Hawaiian, go away, come back. All of those themes, I think, show up very deeply in my music, and in a lot of ways are my ways of being able to just journal, archive some of the most precious moments and deeper learnings that I have as I'm experiencing them in real time as a person. Yeah.
Can we talk about the song Hana Maui Sunrise?
Oh, yeah,
100%. I was so struck by that. And it's quite relevant to what you're just talking about of your unique perspective and blending genre. But one of the things you do is you include e ala e, right, the traditional morning greeting, alongside these lyrics about grandma's mango tree and hana and this incredibly place-based feeling. E ala e.
I remember in the good old days, building castles in the sand, searching high and low for waterfalls, while you held me by the hand.
What was the process of writing that, and what did you want to accomplish by combining all of those memories and elements?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. So songwriting in general is pretty stream of conscious for me, especially songs like that one. I was knee deep processing the death of my mother and my father in probably like a 2-year span. I'd lost my grandma maybe 6 years before. And so it was a deep mourning experience trying to understand and collect myself and the emotion I was trying to feel of what it meant to go back home. And be home in a place where home had shifted and they weren't there anymore physically. And I had to come to terms with emotion and that feeling. That was that song. That LAU was really something we did so much as a family, as a school, as a community. Hana is on the easternmost part of Maui. It's the first to greet the sun on any given day. And the sunrises there are... they're genuinely in their awe-inspiring. There's really no words to describe how beautiful they are, because you get to see it for the first time. You get to see first light. I just remember so many mornings taking grandma to church or whatever it might be. And you're like, you just see it. You're like, oh, I'm a 14-year-old. I get to see this. This is amazing. And it was a late addition into the song to help me just convey that feeling that being back home and greeting the sunrise again from that place allowed me to reconnect to people who are not there anymore. And that was always there for me as a spot and as a practice to be able to do.
That was musician Stephen Henderson talking with The Conversation's Maddie Bender. Henderson will be performing in our Atherton studio on Saturday, November 15th at 6 p.m. as part of HPR's Celebrate 808 performance series. Look for links on our website later today.
Oh, oh, yeah, I'll tell you about it.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, what's new on the battlefield? We hit the ground with the U.S. Army. Troops have been immersed in military drills that wind up this weekend. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find The Conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm D.W. Gibson. Catherine Cruz will be back tomorrow. Join us then for more of The Conversation.